Good afternoon. Welcome to another Burr News Facebook Live interview. I'm Don Burgess, and today I have the pleasure of sitting with Health Minister Kim Wilson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Don.
Let's jump right into the new health care proposals that government has. You've got a couple options that the way we could go. Just sort of explain what each option does.
Okay, thank you, certainly. Well, let me back up for a moment. Right now in Bermuda, we spend over $700 million per year on healthcare costs. Obviously, that's not sustainable for a population just over 65,000. So what we're looking at is reforming the way that we pay for healthcare costs. Our number one objectives, obviously, are to reduce premiums, contain cost, ensure that everyone has an affordable insurance packet, as well as to improve healthcare outcomes of individuals. And so what we did is back in 2012, we had a committee that was a bipartisan committee that looked at different mechanisms and different ways which one can pay for healthcare costs. They did quite a lot of extensive research, worked with actuaries and the like, and they came up with two proposals for consideration for Bermuda. Fast forward to 2017, 2018, when the government came into power, we looked at that report again, because as I said, it was a very detailed report. And we then, a few months ago, established another steering group. And this was made up of individuals from all walks of life representing insurance, healthcare professionals, and the like. Again, a bipartisan committee to look at those recommendations that came from that 2012 report. And the two principal options that came from that report, which the steering committee just completed reviewing and going back to their stakeholders to say, find out what their thoughts were about these options. There's two principal options, Don. One is what's referred to as the unified system, and one is the dual system. The way that we look at insurance packages now in Bermuda, we've got 65,000 people, for example. If you and I are at an employer that has 10 people, we are pooled together with 10 of us. And if one person has a catastrophic illness, then that will affect the premiums of the rest of us, all nine of us. If you look at it where we're employed with some 2,000 people, and that person, one person has a catastrophic illness, the other 1,999 won't necessarily feel the impact as they would have with the first example. So what we're looking at is pooling all of those persons that are insured into either the unified, which is one pool, or the dual, which is two. It will allow us to contain our cost. It will allow us to develop a mechanism that's a better benefit package. It will allow a number of things. Right now, there's a lot of hemorrhaging, if I can use that word, with respect to the way that we're paying for healthcare costs right now, and it's just not sustainable. My hope is that, as I said, the stakeholders have all produced their commentary and their submissions as to which unified option or dual option they prefer. We're reviewing those as we speak, and I'm hoping to take that to cabinet within the next couple of weeks so that the cabinet can make a decision as to which system we'd like to go ahead and continue for Bermuda.
Just as an example, what you mentioned, I have a friend who used to have a small business. I think it had about 15 employees, but he hired one person who was having health problems just to try to help this lady out. But her health, she was going to Hopkins and Leahy all the time. The health pool for that group skyrocketing. He started losing other employees because they don't, you know, their health insurance premiums were working for him because that one other person he was trying to help out.
Exactly.
Just really skyrocketed, made it unattainable for him to keep employees.
Exactly. And if you think about us pooling a larger pool, we're spreading out the risk, so to speak. So it will make it more economically feasible for individuals. Some people have indicated, you know, why are we looking at healthcare financing now? Why not look at developing a better benefits package, developing a process so that we can assist persons that are underinsured or uninsured, and those type of things. But we can't do any of that unless we can figure out a way that's more economical insofar as how we pay for it, which is why we're looking at the healthcare financing first and foremost. All those other areas are very, very important, equally important, and we'll be looking at those as well. However, we have to first find a way that's economical insofar as paying for those types of benefits. And I think that either the unified or the dual is going to be the best option.
So would that mean that under the unified, everyone's insured with the same insurance company, or they can still choose BF&M?
That's a good question. What will happen is, let's say Unified is the one that's selected, for example. That will be as it relates to the standard benefits, the standard health benefits. However, it doesn't preclude that individual from being in that pool from also getting private insurance, supplemental insurance, maybe for air ambulance or, you know, other types of services. So the insurance companies will all be able to still offer a supplemental benefit, but we're looking at pooling all of the standard health benefit premiums into one pool or two, depending on which way. So you can always get a supplemental benefit. But in addition to this, once we're able to contain the cost and look at a more cost-effective model, then we'll be able to offer a benefit package that covers things like preventative care, it covers things like long-term care, hospitalization, medication, as well as overseas treatment. So we'll be able to develop a better benefit package, so people may or may not choose to supplement it with a supplementary insurance package.
So what might be something that would be included in the basic package, and then maybe something that would have to be supplemental?
Well, right now the basic package includes principally, I guess almost 95% of all of that is hospitalization, local hospitalization. And we would be looking at a package that, in addition to that, would also include things like long-term care. Obviously, we have a growing senior population, and we need to be able to start addressing that issue. So long-term care benefits, medication benefits, preventative, which is key, because we spend most of our insurance dollar is based on curing the person as opposed to preventing the illness in the first place. So those are a number of things that I think are critically important that we're looking at as we speak.
What about dental care, eye care? Those sorts of things.
Again, some of those things may very well be offered in the supplemental benefit. We want to just develop a basic package that's affordable for everyone, as well as that covers the items that I just spoke about. Those things will have to be costed out, but it's not, the point being is that there will always probably be a need for some type of supplemental insurance. If you want to have braces, for example, should we have a unified system that covers, pays for braces for everyone, or should that be something that somebody buys privately through a supplemental insurance policy through the private industries?
Now, if I remember correctly, I think Bermuda's got the third highest cost in the world behind the United States, and Switzerland is the other one?
I have some statistics here. I'm afraid I think you're probably about right. We are up there insofar as numbers. Like I said before, Don, $700 million a year. That's almost $11,000 per person that we're spending on healthcare costs. And we are certainly one, we may not be leading the pack, but we're certainly up in the high runnings.
The population report came out, mm-hmm. and it's projecting that our seniors over the age of 65 are going to be like 24.6% of the population in 2026. Mm-hmm. How does this exacerbate the problem?
Bermuda is not dissimilar to any other jurisdiction. Obviously, we have a graying population. Unfortunately, as you know, as we get older, we start feeling ailments, and we obviously get sicker and so forth as our age increases. So with that, we're seeing that as we're living longer as well. So in theory, we have a population that is living longer and sicker. So you can obviously recognize that that has a crumbling cost factor on our healthcare system, because they're absorbing more of the healthcare dollars because of the illnesses and the like. So if they're sicker for a longer period of time, we've got an aging population that's also sicker, then that's obviously going to be a drastic impact on our healthcare dollars. What we're looking at as well is that when we set a premium, because like I said, we're going to add an element of preventative care. So it's great that if you have that preventative care, then if you're living longer and you're weller, it's going to cost A, less money to the healthcare system, and B, obviously your quality of life is going to be improved. So we certainly have to add a preventative care element within our benefits package. But again, like I said, Bermuda is not dissimilar. As we age, our statistics are grave insofar as we're aging, and it's almost like a chart. So you can see that when you look at the healthcare dollars, it increases as the people get older.
Yeah, I think like your ministry and probably pensions are probably the two biggest areas where that impacts the most.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
You talk about preventative measures. Mm-hmm. So what sort of things might be in that bailiwick of adding preventative to the healthcare?
That's a good question. As you know, unfortunately, our statistics are dire as it relates to non-communicable chronic diseases. We're, again, one of those top-numbered countries as it relates to diabetes, incidence of diabetes, and diabetes-related amputations and the like. I think we're like second in the OECD for leg amputations as a result of diabetes. So these are lifestyle diseases, right? Some people call them the disease of the affluent. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at preventative, we want to look at ways where you can, you know, develop weight loss programs, things like that, to help the person before they get to a diabetic state. So it would be similar to, you know, weight management, things like that, that you would be able to have costed under your benefits package, so that before a person gets diabetic, they have the proper tools so that they can manage their weight, manage their blood pressure, things like that, things to prevent them from getting into a chronic non-communicable disease state.
Yeah. Now, I know this isn't very popular, but the sugar tax, how does that play into trying to prevent maybe diabetes and some of these other issues?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's critical. All the studies that we've been able to review in anticipation of rolling out that, we did heavily consultation, as you know, with the public with respect to the sugar tax. It's still early days. It only became implemented on the 1st of October for 50%, and then in April it will increase to 75%. However, recognizing, like I said, the high instances of diabetes in Bermuda, the hope is that it will curb person's appetite, so to speak, for sugary substances, things that have absolutely no nutritional value that we're consuming in vast quantities. Our studies have shown that, you know, the for every extra pound that you're gaining, there's obviously a knock-on effect as it relates to, you know, poor health outcomes. We've also seen that in many jurisdictions, when they've implemented an economic sanction, so to speak, on a particular item, such as a sugary soft drink and the like, that there have been good results. So it is still early days. However, we're very confident that we're going to see results for the better as it relates to persons' healthy lifestyle choices. Another thing that we actually mentioned just on that vein in the throne speech is to some of the money that's going to be coming from sugar tax. We've always maintained that it would have to go to help to educate and promote healthy lifestyles. So this time, what we're looking to do is to assist restaurants to develop healthy option menus, so that when you look at a menu and you can see this particular item that I wish to consume has X number of calories, X number percentage of fat, X number of sugar, etc., so that it allows the consumer to have more information at their, you know, in their mindset before they actually order that meal. Not many of us have these nutritional accolades and academics behind us. However, if you look at something on the menu and it's speaking to you about how much it's going to weigh, I mean, how much fat content, etc., you may think twice about ordering that whole pizza and then maybe share it and have a piece of salad to go with it.
Well, this is done in other countries.
It's certainly, with success.
Yeah. Although, yeah. So I have to admit, sometimes when I go into a restaurant and if I want something, I see the calories or whatever the content is, I still order what I want.
And that's true. And we're not, everything has to happen in moderation, right? I'm not saying don't ever consume a cheeseburger, but at the same time, if you notice that
bacon too.
Yeah, with bacon. But then if you notice it adds, when you add the cheese and the bacon and all the other things is adding up in calorie content, you might decide, you know, I really do want that cheeseburger, but maybe I'll forego the bacon and the avocado and whatever. But it's just about giving consumers proper information so that they can make proper decisions about their best health outcomes, particularly as it relates to consuming foods.
Now, the second part of the sugar tax takes effect when?
The second part, right now it's 50%, and then on April 1st it will increase to 75%.
And when do we hope to get some data from that to say...
To see what we're doing? Yeah. Actually, I can't say at this point. We will
Although the retailers may moan that they're selling less soda and things, but...
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting because when you look at the consultation period, right, and the consultation results showed that there was a majority of persons that felt that we should have some type of implementation of a sugar tax. In fact, they also indicated that chocolate should be included within that sugar tax. Now, at this point, when we rolled it out for October 1st, we were unable to do chocolate now because there's this issue concerning the customs tariff and the like. So we're working with Ministry of Finance and, in particular, the Department of Customs to see whether that's something that can be done. However, again, the consultation strongly suggested and supported the implementation of a sugar tax.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were, I guess one of the things that a lot of people were questioning is why wasn't chocolate included?
Exactly.
Because that would seem like an obvious choice.
You're right. And it is simply because of the way that the customs tariffs are, everything has a code, and it would have been a very, very problematic at that time. It's not to say that it won't happen, but at the customs, like I said, are working with us, but there's a tariff for everything. And it's somewhat complicated, but the customs tariff itself, it wasn't as easy as to be able to remove chocolate from the tariff when there's so many other codes that are associated with items that may contain an element of chocolate, et cetera. It was a little bit more of a complicated exercise.
Now, you recently introduced the Child Care Standards Act.
What we did is last January, actually, the ministry, in consultation with child care providers, rolled out child care standards, mm-hmm. and they are effectively to allow for actually the document itself, which can be located on our website, is very, very useful. Mm-hmm. It's for parents, it's for child care providers, as well as persons that work within the child care field, the teachers and the like. And it provides the minimal standards that are expected for children insofar as in the child care setting, such as playtime, health and safety, travel standards, et cetera. So it's a very comprehensive document, which, again, utilized the expertise of those persons within the industry. The ministry consulted heavily with them, so they participated with respect to this exercise. It's going to be reviewed on an annual basis to ensure that best practices is maintained, and if there's any issues that arise through the implementation of the standard, then they can be addressed as well. So we've seen quite a lot of usefulness of the standards, and like I said, they came out last year, January, and you know, from all accounts, they're being very, very utilized, and it's meeting the expectations that we had with respect to persons referring to it as a very, very important guide.
Is there anything from the industry or maybe from parents saying that they would like to have as an extension of that?
Not to my knowledge. It is an evolving process, and the input that we receive from stakeholders will be reviewed on an annual basis. So by all means, we've invited parents and stakeholders alike that if there's anything that they feel that the standards should also contain or clarify, et cetera, for them to email the ministry so that they can be addressed accordingly.
Now, also earlier this year, you had the public consultation on mental health.
Yes.
So how's that process going?
It's not moving as swiftly as I would have liked. However, I am pleased to say that we will be looking at amendments to the Mental Health Act, and that legislation is earmarked to be tabled probably next week, certainly this session. Unfortunately, we won't be able to debate it this session, but as long as it meets the calendar and has been tabled, then I'll be pleased. And it's looking to be tabled next week, actually, so stay tuned.
Anything you can tease us with beforehand?
It addresses a number of matters that the public that were raised during the consultation period. So our legislation is very, very dated, and it probably needs complete reform, but at this point we're doing some of the things that throughout the public consultation that were identified as areas of weaknesses that needed to be addressed pretty expeditiously. So that's what we'll see in this piece of legislation due to be tabled, like I said, next week.
No, not to focus in on any one specific thing, but it seems like mental health issues in the past, there's been a real stigma to it. It's a little less so mm-hmm. now as people are more open about what's happening, especially like more people dealing with anxiety
yes.
and depression
yes.
and the stress
yes.
of life. You know, how can we better able help this group of people to?
I think, thank you for asking that. I think one of the best mechanisms for that is what we're doing right now and talking about it and just being open about the fact that mental illness is no different than a physical illness. The main difference is that you may not see it. The person may be feeling it. If I break my arm and I have a sling, then you obviously are going to say, Kim, what's wrong? Mm-hmm. Something's clearly seen because you're visibly seeing it. But however, mental illnesses sometimes can be viewed as a silent illness. The person that's feeling it knows it, but the members of the public don't. And if we continue to engage in conversations like this, I think it will go a long way to reducing the stigma because it's no different than a physical illness.
Well, I do cover a lot of court for Burr News.
And, oh, you do? Okay.
And unfortunately, there's been a lot of gentlemen showing up in court and dealing with mental issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the refrains that I keep hearing in court, well, it's going to take 6 to 8 weeks for them to get assessed because there's only Dr. Hennigolf to deal with the issue.
Right.
And, you know, people are saying we need more resources and things.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, there's one gentleman in specific, they felt like his condition was deteriorating mm-hmm. at Westgate
mm-hmm.
and needed to move out of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can we do I don't want to say criminals in the sense, but mm-hmm. you know, those who've offended.
Yes, who have.
And Westgate's probably not the best place for them, but
right.
Maui's not the best place for them either because of their
Right. Well, it does take, that's a good question, Don, and it does take, you know, a joined up government effort. Obviously, the issues as it relates to persons that have been diagnosed with a mental illness and are currently serving a term of incarceration, that does fall within the Ministry of National Security. Mm-hmm. However, there are, as you said, sometimes there may be challenges with respect to resources, again, and that would be within the Ministry of National Security and or the courts. However, it is something that's recognized. I some of the amendments that we'll see that will be tabled next week will assist in some regard, but that is a broader issue as it relates to persons incarcerated and having mental illnesses and or the courts where they're ordering psychiatric reports and it's taking 6 or 7 months. I can't speak too much about that because it does fall under two other ministries. However, I think just with respect to the Ministry of Health and the amendments that we'll see under the Mental Health Act, it will certainly go a longer way than where we are now to address certain individuals' needs that have mental health challenges.
Going forward into this, the next year, is there something in particular that's close to your heart that you're hoping that the ministry will tackle and get accomplished?
Extended maternity leave. That was something that was in the throne speech, and the government actually has committed to commence the consultation period for that, so that we can look at extending the statutory leave time frame for persons on maternity leave. Everybody knows what the data says insofar as extending the time when a mother has an opportunity to bond with her child. It helps reduce depression and postnatal depression in the mother. It helps reduce certain cancers. It helps continuation of breastfeeding, helps to reduce the onset of obesity in the child. Huge emotional and physical and psychological benefits for extending maternity leave. So I'm looking forward to challenging and championing that.
It's currently 8 weeks or 12 weeks?
Correct, 8.
And you want it to be 12 or
minimal 13, but 13. We're looking at that. Yes.
What for us gentlemen out there, what about paternity leave?
There is under the statute, there is, I think, 2 weeks under the Employment Act for paternity leave, and it that may also come up during the consultation. We're just going to start the consultation period and see where it lands, but it's certainly a commitment that the government made under the platform was to look into the extension of maternity leave.
Now, normally I try to end with something a little light. But since it's health and preventative, so what do you do personally for your physical well-being?
I am a CrossFit fiend. Mm-hmm. So I wake up at 5 o'clock Monday to Friday and head into town and do CrossFit. I enjoy it. It's a great stress reliever because I also enjoy food. Mm-hmm. So it kind of helps to balance out the consumption of food. But, yeah, I do a lot of exercising. Come join me one day.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm usually hugging.
They have a 6 o'clock class. Yeah, well, they have other classes, but it's really fun. So come, I'll do another class with you. You want to go a different time?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. I'm Don Burgess. I was here with the Health Minister, Kim Wilson, who elucidated us with a few of the plans for the ministry and helping make the healthcare a little cheap, hopefully make it a little cheaper in Bermuda.
Yes.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for your time.
And thank you for watching us this afternoon. We hope that you have a beautiful day and a beautiful rest of the week is as beautiful as today was.